From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Having access to the media gives you power. Having access to power gives you power, too. General Electric has access to both. Currently, the company is putting its high-voltage public relations machine to work in a protracted battle with the Environmental Protection Agency. GE is spending millions of dollars in upstate New York to persuade the locals that toxic waste in the Hudson River doesn't need to be cleaned up. Brian Mann of North Country Public Radio reports.
Stand on the bank of the Hudson River, and you'd never know that this is America's largest Superfund site. On the far shore, wood ducks move in a line in the shade of budding trees. But just under the surface lie more than 1 million pounds of polychlorinated biphenyls, a toxic chemical poured into the river by General Electric decades ago. Last fall, the Environmental Protection Agency proposed a massive dredging operation to remove polluted sediment. The cleanup, one of the biggest in U.S. history, would be paid for by GE. Facing a price tag of $500 million, the company responded with an aggressive PR campaign aimed at killing the plant.
These wonderful moments on one of the richest rivers on Earth could be interrupted for the next 20 years if the EPA orders the Hudson dredged. That's right. Removing millions of tons of sediment could take 20 years, and there's no guarantee dredging will work.
Ads and infomercials like this one have aired in heavy rotation on dozens of TV and radio stations. GE launched a sophisticated website and plastered its anti-dredging message on billboards and the sides of buses. GE's television network, NBC, has offered little national coverage of the Hudson cleanup. Critics say the last news story aired some 3 years ago, but pro-environment groups concede that coverage on all the major networks has been light. Still, they were outraged this spring when the president of NBC lobbied government leaders in New York City, urging them to oppose the cleanup. Critics of GE's media blitz say the company may have spent as much as $60 million. The company puts the figure at $10 to $15 million. GE's management has declined to open its books to shareholders who wanted to know the exact cost of the campaign. GE spokesman Steve Ramsey.
That's information that we just generally don't share with the public. We don't think that that's the issue. The issue here should be, what's the right remedy for the Hudson River?
The right remedy, Ramsey says, is to leave the PCBs right where they are. According to GE scientists, the sludge is being contained naturally, buried under layers of river sediment. The company's researchers also dispute government claims that the compound causes cancer.
In my judgment, there is definitely a risk to humans from the PCBs that are in the river.
Dr. David Carpenter is a researcher at the University of Albany who studied the health effects of PCBs for 15 years. He says dozens of studies have suggested that PCBs cause cancer and a long list of other diseases. But many residents of Hudson Falls simply don't believe the research.
A lot of the distrust has been fed by the General Electric attempts and blatant attempts to influence the outcome by casting doubt on the objectivity, the credibility of EPA.
Many locals here have also rejected the EPA's cleanup plan. John Madison worked at General Electric's factory just across the street for 35 years, much of the time handling PCB-laden oils.
I personally feel a lot of people like to talk. They don't understand what they're talking about.
What would it take to convince you that there was a health risk here?
Nobody's going to convince me, because I know better. I know it's a pack of lies.
More than 50 towns and villages along the upper Hudson passed resolutions opposing the cleanup. There are lawn signs everywhere, paid for by General Electric, urging the federal government to leave the river alone. The fact that locals trust a multinational corporation more than the federal government doesn't surprise John Allen, an expert on brands and imaging with Lippincott and Margulies in New York City. Over the years, Allen says, GE has employed sophisticated ad techniques, building the sort of public confidence that other corporations envy.
We bring good things to life. GE. We bring good things to life.
We just bring good things to life advertising that's done, and you see on Sunday morning, this is why they've been building this stuff all those years. It's what good brand management's all about. Now they're leveraging it a bit.
While GE has spent millions making its brand a symbol of quality and trust, Allen says the federal government has built a different sort of image, bound up with taxes and scandal and inefficiency.
GE puts food on the table and cars in the garage, and the government just takes things away from these people. You know, the U.S. government brand is not at the top of the brand equity pyramid, you know.
There is a fundamental distrust, and I think that this has certainly been taken advantage of by General Electric with the ad campaign. It plays on all of those historic fears.
Ann Rishlinsky is a public affairs specialist with the EPA, who's worked on the Hudson River Project for 10 years.
GE is going around telling people we're going to decimate the 40-mile stretch, we're going to yank out the river bottom, they'll close the river down for 20 years. That's nonsense.
Nonsense or not, Rishlinsky concedes that the company's campaign has worked.
This is quite unique in that we have a portion of a considerable portion of the Hudson Valley that does not want a contaminant taken out of their midst.
GE and the Environmental Protection Agency have offered two very different visions of the Hudson River. Faced with a choice between the government's dire warnings and the assurances offered in GE's ads, many here have chosen to side with the company. In part, that's because locals worry that dredging will ruin the region's image, slowing tourism and slashing property values. But the EPA's arguments in favor of the cleanup have also seemed muddled and bureaucratic when matched against GE's polished message. Andy Melee heads a pro-environment group called Sloop Clearwater.
GE's media strategy has been to get you to distrust government, to distrust science. They've turned this whole area into the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. I think every polluter is out there watching General Electric on this one, going to school on it.
The EPA will make its final ruling on the Hudson cleanup in August. If the government decides to move forward, GE's media campaign is expected to continue as the corporation shifts its fight to the courts. For On the Media, I'm Brian Mann in Hudson Falls, New York.
Some newspapers seem to be defined by their editors. Ben Bradley and the Washington Post of the 1970s comes to mind. At other papers, the editor's personality tends to be subordinated to the institution itself. Such has been the case historically with the New York Times. In recent years, however, first Max Frankel, then Joe Lelyveld, very much put their imprimaturs on the great gray lady, and now comes another succession. In September, editorial page editor Howell Raines will succeed Lelyveld in the executive editorship. What effect will the new regime have on the world's most influential news organization? Joining us now to discuss the transition is Lorne Manley, media editor for Inside.com.
Thank you.
Before we discuss what changes the Raines regime might bring, let's talk a little bit about the Lelyveld regime. What do you suppose will be regarded as his legacy at the New York Times?
The move to six sections and color came under his watch, so he'll be remembered for really pushing those through. The writing is better, I think, than in any time of its history. The Times has been known for its Machiavellian struggles, particularly in the A.M. Rosenthal and less so in the Max Frankel regimes. And I think Joe Lelyveld particularly set out to change that. I mean, you're never going to make it a completely non-political place, but it's much less Machiavellian than it was just a decade ago.
Just a more pleasant place to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a more pleasant newspaper to read. You referred to the writing. It's more stylishly crafted than it was as recently as 10 years ago. The reputation, at least as recently as the Abe Rosenthal executive editorship, was that there was a tyranny of the copy desk, and reporters were just hamstrung in terms of trying to write the way they wanted to. How much of that change is attributable to Joe Lelyveld?
I think a lot of it. Prior to Joe, under Max Frankel, you started seeing writers like Maureen Dowd being given much more free rein. That's when she was covering Bush 1. But it was for very few writers. That has been expanded under Joe's regime.
So what can we expect from Hal Raines?
He's just steeped in the place. He's been on the reporting side. He's been on the editing side. He's been on the editorial page side. He understands sort of all the different facets of the paper, believes in investigative reporting and stylish writing, and, you know, having writers who have points of view. That's one thing he brought to the editorial page. I think the opinions became much sharper under his watch on that page than they had been in quite a while.
Well, let's talk about that, because historically the Times editorial page has been known for a sort of compulsive even-handedness, and under Hal Raines, the opinions got very opinionated. Is that a kind of baggage that he must take with him over to the news operation? Will people now, every time they see something they don't like in the Times, wave it as some sort of smoking gun and say, aha, this is editorializing and using the news pages to flog a certain point of view?
I think, unfortunately, he's going to have to deal with it, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it used to frustrate me no end going to the editorial pages of the Times and not understanding what the opinion was. And I don't think you can easily label Howell. I mean, he could be very vociferous in his attacks on the Clinton administration. So he's not your knee-jerk liberal that some people want to paint him as. And I think Howell is a smart enough journalist that he knows what the place for the editorial page is and what the place for the news pages are.
Well, come the autumn, when these changes actually take effect, do you think readers will be able to discern any difference in the New York Times as they pick it up every day?
No. I think the institution is so strong. Howell's not going to come in and say, boom, you know, here's major changes. I think things move very deliberately and very slowly at the New York Times. So I think changes are going to be gradual. And maybe in a year, you'll pick it up and you'll start noticing things.
No headless body and topless bar?
I don't think so.
Horoscope?
Possibly, but a very upscale one.
All right. Thanks very much.
No problem.
Lauren Manley is the media editor of Inside.com. Coming up, a look at the MTV show Jackass. Does it turn kids into idiots? And the Rudolph Giuliani saga plays like grand opera.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The sneakiest, really sleaziest way to do a sensational story without appearing to be indulging in sensationalism yourself is to do it as a media story. Here at On the Media, we decry that kind of behavior. But can you believe what's going on with New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani? Giuliani's prostate cancer, his short-lived run for the Senate against Hillary Clinton, and especially his marital woes have placed him front and center in tabloid headlines, on the cover of People magazine, and on network shows like Good Morning America.
The cast of characters in this operatic saga include the ailing mayor with the extramarital appetite and the infamous temper,
get lost,
the spurned wife with Hollywood ambition, the girlfriend with no fear of the spotlight, and the celebrity divorce lawyer with a habit of saying nasty things about his client's wife.
Apparently, they're going to have to pull her kicking and screaming from Gracie Mansion. But somewhere, somebody has to say to her, get a life.
Stories like Giuliani's draw reporters and their audiences the way the moon pulls the tide. Of course, the mayor maintains it's all the media's fault and turns his anger on the reporters.
Most of the thrust of this is coming from you, not the people that are involved. They really would rather not talk about it. But you're relentless. People jump out of cars. Virtually, people can't go to the bathroom without, you know, being covered. So if you would just back off, then nobody would comment on it.
Both the media and the political establishments here say the mayor had it coming. During his 7-year tenure, he had systematically shut down smaller city public information offices, leaving City Hall the only news source. Then in his daily briefings, he would routinely ridicule the press corps for asking inconvenient questions, as when this week, one reporter asked if he would tell his close associates not to talk about his personal life.
There's a hypocrisy in your asking me that. And I don't mean that personally. I mean it as an institution. You are relentless in your quest for information about this. Relentless. So sometimes you get it.
Given the mayor's penchant for total control, it's unlikely that any of his associates would have spoken up without his consent. Yet all the comments have come from the mayor's side, most notably from a source, probably his lawyer, Raoul Felder, who told the press that cancer treatments had rendered the mayor impotent. Felder also attacked Giuliani's estranged wife as a bad mother, who, he said, was, quote, screaming like a stuck pig.
The lawyer went into this as if he were invading Normandy instead of trying to settle a dispute between the alleged grown-ups.
Pete Hamill is a novelist, a columnist, and a lifelong newspaper man.
So I think the media had to report that, not so much what was revealed in that field of combat, but the fact that it was seen as combat itself.
The battle was joined a year ago when the mayor announced that he was separating from his wife in an impromptu press conference, which is how she found out about it. Former New York City Mayor Ed Koch.
It's not the media that created this story or enlarged it. It is Rudy who created and enlarged the story.
But Koch doesn't deny the media may be taking unusual satisfaction in its job this week, because after nearly two terms in office, the prosecutor-turned-mayor still treats the media as hostile witnesses under cross-examination.
The press doesn't like him because he doesn't like them, and he treats them shabbily, and he intimidates them and goes over their heads to complain when he doesn't agree with them. And there's no question that everybody knew that on the first occasion where they could kick him down the steps, they would.
It was like a gift, a glorious gift.
Ellis Hennekin is a columnist for Newsday.
We knew this. Folks, we've been trying to tell you this stuff for a long time. You didn't want to listen. Now look, here's the Rudy you thought you loved.
Throughout his tenure, when matters such as police shootings and racial tension have called for exquisite sensitivity, Rudy defends the police first and asks questions later. Finally, now that the mayor is a lame duck, a wounded duck in fact, and incapable of exacting his usual retribution, the local press has license to report on the Rudy they know. That explains the enthusiasm of people like Hennekin. It doesn't explain why the national media have picked it up and run with it, like CNN's Burden of Proof.
If she feels, as the mother, that it could be in some ways damaging to the children to suddenly find another woman in their father's life, I mean, isn't that something the court should be concerned with?
You bet. And that happens generally with younger children, not with children of this age. And that would also be a more accurate statement, Roger, if we didn't have all this media coverage. There is no question in my mind, and I don't think anyone on the show or anyone in the country who's been watching this, I don't think anyone would question that the children know precisely what's going on in their parents' lives.
Mitchell Moss is the head of New York University's Taub Urban Research Center.
It's not a surprise that a mayor of New York can attract interest. There's no one in Washington who's so interesting anymore. And Rudy fills the vacuum for the nation right now.
He's not your traditional, blow-dry, pleasing politician. He's really the opposite of that.
Newsday columnist Ellis Hennekin.
There is stuff in him, in his character, to admire. But I guess it's the same reason that people are drawn to The Sopranos, right? It's the complexity of the character. Now, I'm not accusing him of killing people, but the fact that there is all of that good and evil and bullyism and angst all twisted into one is what makes him tremendously fun to cover in New York and, I guess, to read about other places.
So this story was just too good for us and the media to leave alone. The question is, was it as good for you as it was for us?
Somewhere around the beginning of last year, Giuliani stopped being a politician and became the subject of a novel.
Journalist and novelist Pete Hamill.
The revelations about his father being a gangster, the cancer, the campaign with Hillary that didn't happen and the withdrawal, the love affair, the nastiness of the divorce, all happened in 1 year. It was like a Job year. If he turns it into opera, Rudy the musical, then we're in a lot of trouble.
Nobody can say the saga of Rudy Giuliani is important news. After all, the media took plenty of hits for singing the ballad of Clinton and Monica too much, and that at least had the threat of impeachment to justify the coverage. No, Giuliani's story is simply drama, or more precisely, melodrama. If there are 8 million stories in the Naked City, the mayor is supplying roughly half of them.
What we have just heard was what they used to call a human interest story. That's because it's been shown that humans are interested when autocratic mayors of world capitals play out timeless morality tales on the evening news. According to author Jack Lulley, that's no accident. In his book Daily News Eternal Stories, The Mythological Role of Journalism, Lulley argues that journalists, consciously or unconsciously, can't resist reaching for mythic archetypes in reporting the news. Jack Lulley, we've just listened to the Giuliani saga. What a mess, but in its way also very appealing. Why is that?
Well, those kind of news stories I think almost always are appealing, and it really gets to the root of what news is. We spend a lot of time thinking about news as information, but I think news is most important for readers and for journalists as story.
Are you suggesting that the essential truth of the event is not relevant, but only the storytelling, the narrative rendering of it?
An event doesn't really happen outside of a narrative, and so we get the events most often in terms of story. Most of us have never met the mayor or his wife or his mistress, but we know plenty about them, and we know because of the stories that they've been placed within.
Now, you've gone back to a number of ongoing news stories, and you've broken them down according to general categories of mythic archetypes. Could you describe them?
When I'm talking about myth in the book, they're the sacred stories of humankind, these eternal stories. Modern society likes to think it has no need of myth, but we get myth daily in the news. We get myths of the hero. We get myths of the victim. We change the names. We change the locales, but the stories remain the same.
If the reality of journalism is what you've observed to be, what problems does this create?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems, first of all, is not recognizing the storytelling function of news. An example I use in the book is the coverage of Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa was portrayed as the good mother. That telling of the story left out a lot of things, left out controversy surrounding Mother Teresa. Here was a nun who was preaching against birth control in a country that probably their major problem was overpopulation. Those kinds of things never got talked about, however, because of the focus on the good mother myth.
Okay, well, for example, David and Goliath, Odysseus, these are stories of the hero.
Right. And in my book, I talk about a modern telling of that story, and that's Mark McGuire. They are almost exactly the same story. We have the hero born into humble circumstances, and he rises above adversity. He goes through a dramatic quest, and then he returns a conquering hero. All we've done there is update the story for our times and put it on the front pages.
So is there anything that we can divine from the way the Giuliani story has been told thus far, for example, how it's been framed by the press, that gives us greater insight into these characters?
I think that plenty of people find this to be one of the places where the news has gone off track again. I know the mayor himself thinks it in those terms. And he asked the reporters, you know, what kind of value does this have for the people of New York? But again, he's thinking of news as information, and he's probably right. The information value of the mayor's news story is very little. But for people who are looking at marriages and relationships and how those things should be done, the Giuliani story gives us a way to think about that and a way to talk about it.
Jack Lulley, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
Jack Lulley is the author of Daily News Eternal Stories, The Mythological Role of Journalism. These days, the hottest media property among the teenaged male demographic is the MTV program Jackass, wherein each week a collection of skateboarders and daredevils put themselves in harm's way for the sake of putting themselves in harm's way. But as frequently occurs when dangerous stunts are performed before an impressionable audience, Jackass has come to be blamed for a number of injuries to youngsters mimicking those stunts throughout the country. On the Media's producer-at-large Mike Pesca has the story of the Jackass backlash.
Ever watch kids skateboarding in a park or any public place with things like stairs and railings? They seem not to mind crashing. In fact, it's almost as if the skateboarding is secondary to the real fun of falling down in a cool way. Johnny Knoxville, the main Jackass on MTV's Jackass, got his start in the world of skateboarding. It would be inaccurate to call any of the stars of the most popular new show on MTV stuntmen. Stuntmen try to avoid injury. The jackasses have a relationship with pain like sumo wrestlers have with fat. They celebrate it as the means to their success. That's why the somber warning that begins each episode of Jackass doesn't seem in keeping with the aesthetic of the program.
Warning: the following show features stunts performed either by professionals or under the supervision of professionals. Accordingly, MTV and the producers must insist that no one attempt to recreate or reenact any stunt or activity performed on this show.
And MTV has taken to airing sound bites of Johnny Knoxville telling his loyal fans to leave the jackassing to the professionals.
I'm begging, you know, asking, please don't try this at home. We're the ones who are supposed to take the hits, not the people at home.
What's behind Knoxville's plea are reports which began to surface in January of teens and preteens copying stunts from Jackass. After Knoxville intentionally set himself on fire and used his body as a barbecue on the show, 13-year-old Jason Lind attempted the same stunt at home. MTV had a lawsuit on its hands, and Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman had a cause. Dan Gerstein is Lieberman's director of communications.
Mr. Lind called our Hartford office asking to speak to the senator, and they ended up connecting, and he appealed to the senator for his help.
Gerstein is in the position of using media to fight media. A week after the Lind incident, Lieberman's office learned of 12-year-old Thomas Hitz, who had also burned himself imitating the human barbecue stunt. Gerstein pointed interested members of the media to the case.
And some of the reporters have asked us whether we know of other copycat incidents. And because the family in Florida not only contacted us but asked us to help publicize their case to call attention to the problems with the show, I believe we just sent a copy of the letter along to Entertainment Weekly along with the correspondence that we had with MTV and the response we got from MTV.
Entertainment Weekly's story led to great television interest because there was video footage to accompany the story. Thomas Hitz and his friends had taped the incident in the hopes that MTV would put them on the air. The Hitz family appeared on ABC's Good Morning America. ABC's 2020 also interviewed the family and played the footage repeatedly. 3 weeks later, officials in Kentucky released a tape to the media showing a 16-year-old boy being hit by a car in what the police said was another example of teenagers copying Jackass.
The video, which you are about to see, is very disturbing. With one boy taping from a yard, another in the car, a 17-year-old drives into a 16-year-old as he runs to the car. Police estimate the car hits the teen going 30 to 40 miles per hour, and he lives.
NBC's Ann Thompson was one of several reporters to air slowed-down footage of the stunt from different angles. In the discussion after Thompson's report on CNBC's Rivera Live, Geraldo Rivera and guest Marcia Clark had seen enough.
Actually, that video, I don't want to see it again.
No.
It reminds me of what Robert Downey Jr. just did to his life.
Yes. The inspiration for the car stunt was later called into question when it was pointed out that Jackass never depicted anyone being intentionally hit by a car, but a Reebok commercial had featured a similar stunt. No matter. Like horror comics of the 50s and Dungeons & Dragons in the 80s, Jackass had become the symbolic and literal jumping-off point for media-influenced recklessness among America's young people.
I want to call parents, I want to call educators, I want to call every expert in the world to say what a trashy, terrible thing this is, and I want to see if some public humiliation might depress the ratings, because you know what?
Jackass and the grisly stunts it inspired were everywhere. Fox News, CNN, ABC, NBC... everywhere except CBS. CBS and MTV are both owned by the media conglomerate Viacom. In the past, CBS has shown an eagerness to promote its sister network. CBS's Super Bowl halftime show featured fans holding up signs which read, "I love MTV." CBS News teamed up with MTV in reporting on the drug ecstasy. But coverage of Jackass, which put MTV in a bad light, was entirely absent from CBS programming, with the exception of Johnny Knoxville's appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman.
And then there was the thing where you were barbecuing yourself and then some kid did the same thing and he was injured, but is he all right now, that kid?
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
How old was the kid?
I believe he was a 13-year-old young man, and that was unfortunate. I hate when anyone hurts themselves, especially in that instance. We always have disclaimers on the show,
right?
Verbal and written, and every interview I've ever given, I said, please don't try this at home. And
well, I think the name of the show in and of itself would be the deterrent you're
right.
Looking for. Just like, if I do that, I'll be a jackass.
Right. Well, but he is.
Morning news viewers would have seen the Today Show and Good Morning America cover Jackass-inspired injuries on six different dates. The CBS Early Show never reported on the issue. Producers and executives at the Early Show would not comment on the matter, but CBS did issue a written statement which read in part, "Each day, editorial decisions are made about what the broadcast will cover, independent of what our competitors are doing. The result is a news broadcast with journalistic independence and integrity, and not one which simply, quote, follows the crowd." If CBS were to report on Jackass, the coverage would be complicated by the lawsuit Viacom faces from the family of Jason Lind, the first boy to be injured copying Jackass. Also, broadcasting graphic footage of supposed copycat crimes carries its own potential risks. If stunts on TV can inspire imitation, why can't repeated airings of the copycats have the same effect? Mark Hitz, the father of the Florida boy, said his motivation in publicizing his son's third-degree burns was so that parents across America could see how irresponsible Jackass was. When I asked him if he was worried that children would copy the videotape of his son's injury, he said no. That video showed consequences. On Jackass, he said, they just get up and go on to the next stunt. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, the Washington scandal that wasn't, and the Washington columnist that isn't.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When George W. Bush first assumed the presidency, word was he had moved into a White House in shambles. The W's had been removed from the White House computer keyboards, phone lines had been cut, and worse. The late night comics had a field day. The New York Post dubbed it Vandalgate.
Let's not dwell in the past, said the new administration, and the White House press corps for the most part didn't. One exception was the Kansas City Star. 2 weeks after new W's had presumably been secured, the Star ran a story which said that there were almost no facts to back up all those rumors and unnamed sources. Last week, an independent report requested by Republican Congressman Bob Barr found no evidence of vandalism in the White House. The Kansas City Star, unique among daily papers, immediately put this news on the front page in an effort to set the record straight. David Goldstein is the Washington correspondent for The Star who wrote both of those stories, and he joins us now. Mr. Goldstein, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Now, for a story that had so few hard facts and no named sources behind it, it was just chock-a-block with juicy details.
Yeah.
Severed computer cables, phone lines, filing cabinets glued shut, switched telephone extensions, desks overturned, scrawled lewd graffiti, computer printers loaded with pornographic images, and Air Force One absolutely trashed.
Absolutely trashed. I mean, it sounded like a hurricane hit it or something.
So where did all of these juicy details come from, if not from the Bush administration?
I don't know. No one told me any of these things. I dropped in on the story sort of all after the fact to try and trace it down, and I could never find any White House aides that would own up to any of this. And when you try to check into some of the things that were reported, for instance, a column in U.S. News reported that thousands of dollars was being spent by the White House to repair phone lines. And so I called a White House aide and said, check into this, and they checked into it and said, I couldn't find anything like that at all. I think, you know, and this is speculation on my part fed by other people I've talked to that were sort of on the inside and have some better knowledge of this than me, and that is that for some reason they must have found it to their advantage that this, I think they thought this advanced President Bush's agenda.
It doesn't seem as if the Bush administration spokesman, Ari Fleischer, did much to tamp the flames.
They did nothing to sort of dissuade people of the story in the beginning. And at the same time that they were sort of, on the one hand, saying one thing about it, on the other hand, in private, other aides were saying other things about it. And then, you know, Ari Fleischer would say at one point he was cataloging the problems, but then the next day, you know, he would start to backpedal a little bit and say, well, it was really just a single aide who was keeping track in his head about things. And you wonder why they did this, because I think it backfired on them. You know, our first story about this and came about because, you know, the story had been breaking, and it seemed really bizarre. You know, there was no verification of this. And our reader representative in Kansas City, you know, in the Star's main office, started getting some calls from readers saying, you know, what is this about? You know, is this stuff true? You know, we had been wondering about this to begin with, and then we started getting calls from readers. They were interested in it. So we said, well, what's going on? And all it took, I just made a call out to Andrews Air Force Base and talked to one of the public affairs officials out there and said, is any of this stuff true? Because they have to catalog everything that, you know, that comes back on the plane, the condition of the plane. And he said, you know, there were some broken glasses and that was it.
Isn't it interesting that it was a request from readers for actual facts that spurred your investigation? Does this say something about journalism in our time?
Well, it's kind of refreshing, but it does say something. Yeah, it does. You know, I think it's really distressing. I think it's also distressing that the follow-up story last week about the GSA report was really buried by most of the major papers.
You wrote that the GSA released its report without a hint of fanfare.
I was told when I was reporting this that there's not really like an official report. There's a letter to Congressman Barr in which they sort of spell out what they found or did not find. So every couple of weeks or so, I would call them to find out, you know, what's happening with this report. Are you done yet? Are you done yet?
You and probably no one else.
Well, I wasn't aware that anyone else was. I mean, you always like to be aware if someone else is following something that you're following. And it, you know, it was no great skill on my part to do that. It's just making a couple phone calls every couple of weeks or so. There's not a lot of deep investigation going on here. It was just some phone calls. You know, you don't have to be either a Democrat or Republican or whoever to recognize that, you know, this wasn't right. You could be the biggest Clinton hater, you know, in all humanity and recognize, you know, when faced with the facts, this was just not right.
Well, thank you, David Goldstein.
You're welcome. Anytime.
David Goldstein is a Washington correspondent for the Kansas City Star.
At a time when publications are trying so hard to differentiate themselves in the media marketplace, it's difficult to pick up a magazine or a newspaper these days without seeing some sort of brief question and answer format, usually with a celebrity subject. Of course, each publication puts their own slightly different spin on them. Very slightly different spin. New York Magazine has The Big Question, Sports Illustrated has The Burning Question, and The Industry Standard has Just One Question. Rolling Stone, The Source, Columbia Journalism Review, Content and Time call theirs Q&A. Vanity Fair's is George Wayne's Q&A, and Time's Q&A shouldn't be confused with Newsweek's Questions and Answers. Maxim's entry is appropriately right to the point. We want answers. We do, too. So the question we asked on the media's John Solomon is, why there are so many questions? His answer.
Each week, Joel Stein earns a paycheck from Time magazine for asking four or five questions to celebrities. So when you turn the tape recorder around on him and ask why there are so many Q&As, he tries to deliver for the interviewer.
They're really easy to do compared to writing because you get to skip that middle step where you just interview someone and type it. You don't actually have to turn it into real sentences.
But it's not just Stein's laziness. The format is actually easier for everybody, including the magazine, which can fit in more recognizable faces without much effort. For one particularly sought-after group of readers, it's ideal.
Particularly among younger readers, they do have a shorter attention span. They want things that are more scannable.
Steve Randall oversees interviews at Playboy magazine.
They do not want to read, you know, 6,000-word pieces about an actor or an actress or a director. And I think that's perfectly logical. Coincidentally, you have celebrities who have so many demands upon their time that they are willing to give less and less access. So these two things have converged into the proliferation of these shorter celebrity Q&As.
Randall says Playboy, which already runs the granddaddy of the long interview, as well as 20 questions, has added more short Q&As in order to appeal to young men, who apparently like Q&As with their TNA. The short Q&A format also fits nicely into a broader magazine taster's menu trend, giving readers a wide array of small portions from which to nibble.
Q&As are something you can kind of actually read without sitting down and focusing. You can actually read them while you're turning the page, which is always a benefit, I think.
Steve Randall says that in most cases, the short interview replaces a longer celebrity interview, not a global warming feature.
There's a time and a place for rigorous interrogation. I think that most celebrity journalism, there's no there. So there's no reason to be doing rigorous interrogation. What, does Drew Barrymore have to confess?
Neither does Stein suffer any guilt that his Q&As will divert time readers from weightier fare.
I think the kind of person that is going to not read the missile defense story isn't, their excuse isn't going to be, well, I read the Hasselhoff Q&A, so I guess I can skip the Star Wars package. If anything, I feel like I've saved them from reading a whole story about David Hasselhoff by just writing a third, page Q&A on him.
Though Stein likes to ask mischievous questions. He once asked Donny Osmond, whose Broadway show closed on the first night, if he blamed himself or the composer George M. Cohan. He thinks the Q&As are fairer to the subjects.
I mean, when you do a print interview, the writer really has complete control over how you look and how you're presented. The Q&A, yeah, I can ask certain questions, but they're being presented really in a straightforward way. It's just what they say. It's being cut. But compared to, starting a story with Adam Sandler thinks he's much funnier than he is, if it's just me saying, do you think you're much funnier than you are? It's not as authoritative, and he gets to respond at least.
And while the interviewee risks exposure in this format, so does the interviewer.
It takes balls, whereas, you can sit down with NSYNC and be very nice to them and then destroy them in your article back home alone in your office. If you're going to really go after NSYNC in a Q&A, you've got to do it very upfront and very honestly with them.
As impromptu as the Q&A may seem, Stein realizes he's getting a performance from most of his subjects.
You get probably a less real side of them because they know it's being taped. They know every word of theirs is being used. So they never really get to relax and back down and be themselves. On the other hand, you're getting a real dose of how they sound and talk compared to an article where there's just a couple of quotes sprinkled throughout.
During a Q&A with NSYNC, Stein accidentally stumbled into one method of getting more candor.
Sometimes at the end of the thing, I say, well, I have enough. And then they're like, well, thanks for doing this. And then they start talking as if we're not recording anymore. The tape recorder's still on. I've just said thank you. And then they suddenly like, wow, I just want to tell you this. And they just start talking. And that's the only time you get something a little more real, either at the end or the beginning.
Stein says it is tough to do a really good Q&A, but he's not working without a net. Every Q&A is edited, cleaned up, and even the questions are rearranged to make it more entertaining. In Steve Randall's new novel, Other Side of Mulholland, one of the characters is a journalist who bemoans the proliferation of chat and shoes, short celebrity lunch interviews. But Randall, in his role as nonfiction editor, doesn't view all of these Q&As quite as negatively.
Well, see, I think actually what you're seeing is a good sign. There was a time, particularly, say, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where everything was a celebrity, and celebrities were given incredible amounts of space in each and every magazine. I think there has been a glut. I think readers are tired of it. They still want it, but they want less of it than they did before.
Still, men may need to update the accuracy of their purported rationale for reading Playboy. I read it for the Q&As. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
The nation's capital is full of highly skilled, diligent journalists, but we're not going to talk about them. Instead, we turn our attention to the pompous columnists who stud various Washington bureaus and the Sabbath gas bags, as Calvin Trillin calls them, who ornament the Sunday morning chat shows. Specifically, we'll be taking up the matter of Brandon Slatter, who epitomizes the worst impulses of both.
I was learning a basic technique of journalism, that extending the hand of friendship may lead your fingers into the pocket of revelation. For example, I became attentive to an older woman in the newspaper's personnel office, and from her learned the retirement dates of several colleagues. One must, in short, be able to relate in a human way to men and women of lesser ability and diminished circumstance.
Brandon Slatter is the star of The Columnist, a novel by Jeffrey Frank, now of The New Yorker magazine, formerly of The Washington Post and The Washington Star. Jeff, welcome to On the Media.
Brooke, I'm really glad to be here.
I would like you to begin with as full-blown a description of The Columnist as you can.
People think he's a total swine, and he does manage to sort of, without realizing that he's sort of a dangerous character. Almost everyone he tries to befriend seems to be damaged by his company, and there's somewhat sort of an unfailing trail of not literal bodies, but bodies in his wake throughout his career, from his, say, his first college roommate to his parents to his employers, to his wives.
What motivates him in his own mind is a search for a journalistic truth and honesty at whatever cost to anybody else, I guess with the exception of himself.
Well, he's a very comfortable person. He's very comfortable with powerful people, and he seems to be happiest in the company of powerful people, some of whom are real. I think Dean Rusk makes a walk on, and others do. But he's also motivated by his own success and by his own ambition, and he dreams more than anything of being a syndicated columnist.
People born in an age of television may not understand what it meant to get a column of one's own. But that was my good fortune in the spring of 1968. From the start, I felt the keenest of pleasures. It was as if I'd been starving, and strawberry shortcake covered by warm chocolate was served up. Or as if I'd not been able to gratify myself, and a woman with creamy skin and wondrous breasts, her sweet, hot limbs parted, lay eagerly beside me.
Brandon's proximity to power helped form opinions that turned out to be wholly incorrect.
Well, now, you're talking about the sort of coziness of between journalists and insiders in Washington, and this is the sort of thing that sort of journalist ethicists write about all the time. I don't condemn it. I think Washington's a really small place. I mean, having lived there, it's much smaller than people think. The city itself is only about 400,000 people now. Among those 400,000 people, there's sort of a very tiny archipelago of neighborhoods where these people hang out, and they all sort of know each other. So there's almost no way you can avoid being a so-called insider there, and how you react to that is of course, something else.
Of course, you can help it. I mean, Izzy Stone spent most of his professional life in Washington, made it a point of honor not to cultivate insider sources.
True.
And wouldn't Brandon have been a better columnist if he'd spoken to more people critical of those who hold the reins of power and people on the margins?
Oh, you're wondering what Brandon would have been if he'd been a reporter. You mean if he'd actually questioned what he'd been told? Oh, I'm sorry. No, I didn't understand. Yes, if he had followed the model of Izzy Stone, or in fact a reporting columnist like Mary McGrory, he might have been someone who we would be more accepting of, and perhaps we'd have more respect for him as an independent journalist. But that was not Brandon's way. Brandon tended to sort of be comfortable with people and tended to sort of believe what he was told.
What are the kinds of journalistic sins that you think Slatter commits in his day-to-day life?
I think it's one sin that we're talking about, and the one sin is basically that he really believes that his own opinions carry weight, and that simply to express his opinion is to say something important. Ultimately, it's a sin of laziness and a sin of vanity. But these are sort of human sins as opposed to journalistic sins.
I'm wanted, or so they tell me, because I offer a rare kind of depth. As George Bush the Elder said when he encouraged me to take this autobiographical leap, I've been there. I've been privileged to know and sometimes befriend the most vital people of our time. I've rubbed shoulders, literally so the phrase resonates for me, with everyone. And we've met at receptions, dinner parties, foreign capitals, television studios, and funerals. A great waltz across history's stage.
Do you think that Washington would be buzzing so much if this novel weren't so very close to the truth?
I realize I was trying to write a Washington novel without falling into the traps of the genre, and the genre is pretty deadly. The genre, when I was a kid, I read Alan Drury's Advise the Consent, which I loved. But that genre has now mutated into sort of books with intelligence agencies and politicians and books that begin, the president woke up on the floor of a Holiday Inn with his trousers red and his knees and had no idea how he'd gotten there.
It is the most unforgiving portrait of Washington and Washington journalists of a certain type that could ever be imagined. I mean, why did you choose this? Why did this capture your imagination?
Well, let's say I really was just sort of fascinated by a certain Washington type, and it wasn't until I moved to New York 5.5 years ago that I sort of began to see that I could write about Washington in a sort of fresh way. And I don't think I realized how I felt about Washington until the book was done. It's a very insulated place. It's a very isolated place in a way that you only see when you get away from it. The conversation tends to be or at least in these communities of lawyers, journalists, diplomats, and politicians, tends to be about one thing only. And I think when you get away, you begin to see that the world is larger than this, and that the vendettas that people have against each other perhaps don't matter as much as they matter to the people there, and that the motives for people to write and say this and that begin to look sort of different and almost amusing and from a distance.
I thought the whole book, as funny as it was, left me with a sad and maybe even slightly sick feeling. Maybe it's all the years that I spent in Washington.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that. Do you ever want to go live there again, Brooke?
never.
That's the unqualified answer, isn't it?
How about you?
No.
Jeffrey Frank, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Brooke Gladstone, it was really a pleasure.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Serchuk, Kathleen Horan, and the NPR program Living on Earth.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Brooke's friend, Bob.
Bye, Bob.
Bye.
Funding from the media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.